Hi, welcome to Together Equal Diversity Made Simple, hosted by me, Sarah Aird-Mash.
And me, Andrew Milne.
We'll be talking to guests about how they're working towards making the world more diverse, equal and inclusive. I'm excited to introduce today's guest, Paul Craig, executive producer at Viewed Torch Pictures. Paul has produced a number of films which we'll get to talk about.
Hey, Paul. Hi, how are you? Sorry, I caught me out completely. How's it going?
Great. Welcome to the podcast.
It's yes.
Great to have you as a guest.
Yes.
Before we get started, could you tell us a bit more about yourself and Viewed Torch?
God, how long have we got? So I'll start with myself. Just a small potted history. It's, God, because I'm a bit old now, or I feel a bit old anyway. At 56, I'm now in two diversity brackets, which is being an older person with skills and also being a black male as well. But just thinking back to the 70s and that eight-year-old Paul Craig, just always fascinated with how things were made. And I come from a family, a long line of electronic engineers. When my mother came over from Jamaica, her first job was in a television factory in West London. So my dad worked at the post office before it became BT in the telephone exchanges. My brother trained up as an electronic engineer. Both of my brothers trained up as electronic engineers. So we've always had that fascination with pulling things apart. But my fascination went a little bit further into the visual arts. So even from a young age, I was trying to examine how things were made, music, audio, visuals, both on film and television. So it's the evolution of the eight-year-old child who had a Super 8 camera and used to force his friends to not only watch his films, but also participate in the films that I was making as a youngster, all the way through to the teenager who decided to join the music circus and essentially just run off and play in bands as a really bad keyboardist. I don't know how I got away with it, actually, for so many decades, actually playing quite large gigs and also music producing for well over nearly 30 years from that point. Even now, I still indulge in it, and people still indulge me for some odd reason. And then mixing that with a reasonably sensible job at JVC when it was in the UK properly. And that kind of reignited my love of the visual arts, getting back into sort of television production. And then there was the digital video revolution that happened in the 80s and 90s, which then led me to mix what I was doing in music with going back to what I loved in the visual arts in film and television. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on whether you were there at JVC or not at that particular time, they were offering redundancies. I had two small children. Rather than staying in a poorly paid job, I stayed at home with the kids and tried to decide what to do with myself. And that's when I decided to learn everything about modern film production. And it's now been, I think from the learning process, it's been about nearly 20 years of learning, maybe helping other people too much, and also on the odd occasion going out and practically producing. So it's been a bit of a mixed journey for me, one that you have to almost start yourself in a lot of cases. And I think that's key with most film, television, creative jobs. You almost have to start yourself and then move into a kind of professional arena afterwards.
It sounds like lots of people's dream journeys. It's so cool.
It's more nightmare. No.
It's amazing. And then so that's about you. And then Viewed Torch?
Oh, God, yeah. So the journey for Viewed Torch, it's been a bit of a turbulent one because I originally started Viewed Torch Pictures roughly about 10 years ago with the view to actually build film and television projects, to maybe have a slight consultancy side to it, just to make sure that there's paid work rather than waiting 3 years, say, for a film to be produced. Or in the case of television, you never know when a commissioner is going to say yes, so you could be left hanging. So 10 years ago, started that after just helping everybody out with their own short films and other productions, and ended up just being leaning more into the production consulting side of it. So I was helping out with at script level with the business side of things, if the business direction of a project, or if you were looking for public money for a project, then I would look into that side and see whether the script fitted the kind of needs of that public money, whether that be charities or organizations such as BFI or British Council. And that kind of took over from the actual productions that I wanted to do myself, the films I wanted to make, and it took over from getting involved in larger films. So it was great helping out and consulting with a lot of, say, creatives, producers, writers, directors, but it moved away from what I actually wanted to do. And then essentially after that, you're basically just picking up the crumbs from these consultations. So it just about pays the rent for what you want to do. And then you move closer to, say, 2019. And I had my first opportunity to do my own full feature film. Literally getting it all together, it was going to be like the greatest thing, the greatest British thriller since Get Carter. We based it in the regions. It was going to be based in the Midlands and up near Manchester. All the mechanics were there. And then a few personal family issues got in the way. So I had to leave that with the other producers who were involved. And then after that, we had 2020, which is COVID, got completely wiped out as financially, had to shut the company down. 2021, just to fast forward, tried a sensible job, and we'll speak about this actually. I tried to get a sensible job and I only lasted there 3 months, but we'll have a discussion about that in a veiled way, and spent 2022 deciding whether to get back into film and television. I decided yes, but I decided to do the thing that I wanted to do, which is why the company is called ViewTorch Pictures Media. So it's not only to build film and television projects, but also to use that IP in other places, such as magazines, graphic novels, books. Audio's a big thing, by the way. And just merchandise, just to actually, rather than just waiting around and spending your time for these big projects to emerge, you're still using the ideas and the IP and trying to build audiences with other projects. That's the idea. It's the thing I was too frightened to do 10 years ago. And I've decided I'm not getting any younger, so let's do it now.
So it sounds like you've had quite the varied history and a lot going on in terms of your production and media exposure, which is all great stuff. But building on the film industry as a whole, let's focus on Hollywood here. But so in the past, I think it's fair to say that Hollywood, in terms of diversity inclusion, has been a bit slow to catch up with general society and general communities on the whole. For example, in 2023, we saw the hashtag OscarsSoWhite, and then published research showed that Hollywood was actually going backwards in terms of inclusion of women and people of colour in films and so on. Using your experience in contrast within the British film history, how would you say they compare?
It's speeding up, strangely, slowly speeding up. So the industry generally is very slow to change. It's almost like moving the Titanic away from the iceberg. The iceberg is coming. And for me, the iceberg is what a lot of people in our industry are talking about, skill shortage. So for me, at all levels, not only just entry level, which is where a lot of organizations will concentrate themselves on. But at all levels, I think we're going to see huge problems as far as skills and the people that are actually in our industry. As an industry as a whole, British film, again, a lot of the gatekeepers, as they are called, a lot of the senior executives, because of that mix of, and you see this in most other industries, you see it in banking, you see it in larger industries like petrol, steel, all of the larger industries, you find that when the closer you get to the top, where there are controls for those industries, the less diverse the mix of people are at that top level. I think only now, I think Citibank are the first to have their first female CEO. So it's that bank's been around in various forms for decades, large amounts of decades. And okay, there are a few outliers as far as key people at the top, as far as women or people of colour, black people. Strangely, don't see a lot of disabled leadership as well. That's another thing. Not distracting from the film and television industry, I think just going back to banking, again, there are, when it comes to people who express themselves differently with different sexualities, it used to be a no, absolutely 20 years ago. That's changing now. People are able to be themselves and express themselves. Luckily, in the film and television industry, we've been reasonably okay with sexuality, but then there's a whole other argument about how it's expressed on screen as well. That's something that we haven't got right yet, still. I think there's not enough trickle down from the top because there's not enough diversity at the top of our industry. It doesn't trickle down well. And I know that happens with other industries, but supposedly film and television is meant to be quite fluffy and creative, and you think it would be more open, but in some cases it can be a very closed shop, mainly due to the amounts of money that's involved in producing film and television. As soon as you get to larger productions and larger organizations with more money, it seems to be harder to steer the ship and steer the industry in a direction that actually reflects society. And yeah, that's still quite a huge problem, I would imagine.
Yeah, I was going to say, money seems to be the main driver for innovation and creativity. Unfortunately, fluffy doesn't pay the bills, right?
No, it's great that there are people who are willing to do the work when it comes to making the landscape more diverse. Yes. You'll find that those people who are really willing to do the work don't have the resources, i.e. money, to actually move the needle in any real way. So that is still quite a huge issue, even in film and television.
Yeah, and I suppose it shows the importance of representation as well, because like you said, if the people at the top don't represent what's going on in the industry, but in real life, then how are they going to want to know what's going on or what's in it for them other than making money? So I suppose they focus on what they can do to please the shareholders, I'm going to say.
Yeah, and I think there has been schemes and initiatives which in the past have looked like lip service rather than actual something that's going to create a more diverse landscape over the next 10 years. That is changing slowly. Again, hopefully not too slowly, because I'm old and I would like to see some form of change before I die.
You've got another 10 years, Paul, don't
you? Yeah, I hope so. I hope so, yeah. I feel like, although saying that, you walk through this industry and you feel like you've only got another 10 minutes, because essentially... things are changing. We've got the streaming services. There's a lot of M&A, mergers and acquisition going on within the industry. So it's almost as if it's a bit like the fast food restaurants. It's almost as if McDonald's is going to be the only choice where, oh, I want fried chicken just like KFC, but oh, we've only got McDonald's. And so we are going to end up with an almost single streamed media landscape if all of the mergers occur over the next, what I predict, over the next 3 years, with less choice when it comes to the media landscape being more industrious, less companies being involved, then yes, it will make the whole landscape smaller, and therefore that will mean there are less opportunities to actually diversify the landscape.
Okay. And speaking from your experience, for our listeners, are there any production companies or anything that, or anywhere that they could look out for to find films or any other media that you think is actually worth shouting out and consuming? Obviously not to take attention off what you're doing, but no, to show support for the industry instead of going to the headliners.
Recently, I spent a year mentoring a student from an organisation called Mummy Youth Project, and I would highly recommend speaking to their head, their CEO, Bob Clark, who is an absolute force of nature when it comes to trying to diversify, especially the TV space as well. But his idea of diversification also involves socioeconomic diversity as well as the whole gamut. And he's really practical in a sense of trying to build these students up to get them ready for the rigors of working at an industrial rate within television, but also reminding them that they can be themselves at every turn. I'm not too sure if you've heard of an expression about code switching, where people speak differently. God knows I can't speak differently. It's a wonderful South London upbringing. There's absolutely no chance of me speaking differently. '70s South London upbringing. So that's not going to change. But what Bob encourages is that, yes, be prepared to do the work. Go in and work at the levels that TV companies and TV producers and production companies want you to work at. But always be yourself. Always try not to emulate the people you're working for, because they need to see more difference in their crews.
Yeah.
And I don't know if... Yeah.
I was going to say, getting onto the crew is quite a mission in itself, because you have to work for peanuts. And now a lot of people can no longer do it. So it is relying on those. They're not quite the Nepo babies, a friend of an uncle and their family can support them. And then we then go into the whole representation, because there's a reason why people can't afford to go into industry and be a runner for 2 years, because they believe in poverty. So that's a whole can of worms and you catch a lot of fish, as it were.
Yeah, so that's the other thing as well. It's that whole, oh, my uncle works at a production company and therefore he'll be able to get me in. Is that dying now? I'm not too sure. I still think there's still quite a lot of that going on. And also the other side of the industry is working with people who you've worked with before. Now, I can understand in a production sense that you definitely want to, oh, I've got to get this job done quickly. It's the next Marvel series of Loki. I've worked with George before. George is great at editing, so I'm going to bring George back on board.
Yeah.
But you can't do that and then say, oh, we're aiming to be more diverse. So it's about building that larger sort of black book of skilled people, and also not only building them up, but also maybe transferring people, because again, the other diversity issue is about age as well. So finding people with transferable skills, bringing them into the industry, and actually finding out that they're really useful. It's my goodness, I didn't know that this accountant could help us with line producing this particular television program. So there are transferable skills. There are issues of just opening the door, not only just a little bit wider, but it needs to be opened properly now. And I'm not saying just have quotas and just employ people to say, whoopee-doo, we've done diversity. No, it's more about, it's still going to be based on talent, skills, and what you want out of any particular production, but it's also going to be based on, it really has to be based on mixing the skill base and who you have in that skill base for those productions.
Okay, and so chucking this back to you now on at ViewTorch, you've said you've identified the issues that you've seen. What are you doing at ViewTorch to improve inclusion in films and so on?
I think it's hard to quantify because I naturally include everyone. I tend to find, I think if I'm just going on me personally as a person, I always tend to speak to people who feel or look marginalized. So I'll go to an event, you'll see a whole room of people, you'll see a lot of people go and try and network with the famous person in the room or the big executive. And then you'll see somebody standing in the corner. There'll be maybe a young black man who, and you can just tell that he doesn't feel 100% comfortable in that environment, because I'm not too sure if you've been to events at places like, say, BFI or any of those larger organizations, but sometimes some events, not all events, can make you feel, oh, this is something new and different, I haven't been here before. So you're not going to express yourself or you're not going to be yourself in that environment. Whereas I tend to aim straight for those people and tend to try and find out what they're doing, what they want to do in the space, you know, in film and television, and just maybe try and introduce them to other people as well and keep in contact with them. People who are starting out, people who feel like outsiders are just as important as the heads of larger media organizations. It's all, for me, it's all about possibilities. So going back to ViewTorch, I think it's about building a moneyed, safe place for creatives of all kinds. Just having that door wide open to actually have the conversations. And you're going to come across people and you're going to meet people who don't fit exactly in the talent mix that you need at any particular point. But it doesn't mean that you keep the door shut to actually speak into everybody and just to make sure that you have that space, you have that safe space, and there is that work culture within ViewTorch. And that's got to be built from myself, from the management structure that I have to build, and then any other middle management that I have to build beyond that. So as long as there's that space where people can feel comfortable and they can feel as if they're being heard, and as if their possibilities are not being shut down, which is what happens with people from diverse backgrounds, you find that just from the conversations I've heard, you hear again and again that they feel that they're not being heard. They feel that they're being shut down instantly, and that shuts off possibility. And when you look at the film and television that we've had over the last, say, 6 years, we do need a bit of different. We do need a bit of possibility. There have been some great programs out there, but you just get a sense that maybe we're missing something. And post Brexit, supposedly we're meant to be these big producers of things and big exporters of anything and everything. And I think we're coming up short. One of the sort of aims of ViewTorch is to actually become bigger in the space, become a exporter of what Britain is now. And Britain is a mixed, diverse landscape now.
Brilliant. I know that you've been involved in quite a few initiatives, and I know that also from a project perspective, you worked on lots of projects across sexuality, religion, race, and all that kind of thing. We've talked about the skills shortage and challenges and how you've overcome those. So I was really wondering about what initiatives you've found along your way when you've been working and you've actually been implementing stuff that have been useful and have worked.
Again, I mentioned Mummy Youth, but also We Are Parable. I haven't been directly involved in that. I know the founders, but they have now moved into, on their 10-year journey, they've actually moved into a space where they're starting to answer the questions about senior executives within our industry. So they're doing some very good work. I think Film London recently set together a Breaking the Glass Ceiling initiative, and I've been keeping an eye on that. But essentially, I feel as if my role is to continually question. So when these initiatives pop up from, say, Screen Skills or BFI or any other organisation, I feel my role is to continually question and have dialogue with those organisations just to ensure that they're doing things that are practical rather than just having this sort of almost headline initiative and then it disappears and nothing happens for another year or 3 years and then another headline initiative comes up and then that disappears. If you look at it's a little bit of a worry because if you look at what happened during 2020 with Black Lives Matter, and there were a lot of initiatives which have, in my opinion, some of them have fallen by the wayside. Some of them have morphed into something more useful. But I don't want it to be on a cycle where essentially the initiatives pop up and then all of a sudden they're moved to one side. So it's, I think my job is more about not only just building ViewTorch and building it into something solid and safe for people to be creative, no matter what your background, but also to question exactly what's going on with anything in the landscape, in any initiatives that the government come up with, any larger organisations, just to continually question what's being done and how they're helping, and is it practical? Will it last?
Great. No, that sounds, like you said, I think it's interesting to see the amount of initiatives that are initially launched and then momentum's got lost. But to be honest, that's not to be expected. But we are in a constant state of crisis as a society, really, aren't we? Because it's the housing crisis, the food cost of living crisis and so on. So it's difficult to maintain my momentum. And I find myself as well getting, I wouldn't call it empathy fatigue, because it's just hard to take on everything and still try to be proactive and positive throughout it all. But that's, again, another kettle of fish to go through. On a personal level, though, what would you say is the most meaningful project you have worked on?
Strangely, I did a short film for a director friend of mine, Martin Gooch. And the film had, it was a fantasy one-shot film. It was for Directors UK and ARRI, the sort of film camera company. It wasn't designed as a, and this is what I'm talking about, it's about doing things in the diverse space without overthinking it. So it wasn't designed as a diverse project, yet we ended up with 60% of our crew being female. There was a large, roughly about four people who identified as neurodivergent. Two people with outward disabilities. One was partially deaf. And we didn't actually aim to do that. We just went for the people we thought could help us get this project put together. And I think that's got to be the sweet spot when it comes to making the whole film and television and media space diverse is the fact that you don't even have to think about it. You're just able to just pick out talent, and then afterwards you look at the mix of people who you have within your crew and you think, oh, actually, yeah, that's something we wouldn't have seen 5 years ago even, or 10 years ago, definitely not 10 years ago. If we took that project and transported it back to 2010, it's very unlikely that we would have had that mix or that crew. So that's definitely, yeah, it's, I think it's on Ari's YouTube channel, A Midwinter Night's Dream. So if anybody wants to look it up and have a laugh at an almost Doctor Who-esque gothic fantasy.
That sounds like a Shakespearean mix up of all the titles.
Yes.
Oh, is that the vibe we're going for then?
Yeah, it was. There was a bit of that, but yeah, it leans heavily into gothic fantasy. But there was also another project, Cindy, which is about a lesbian drag queen. And it was more about the story and how society perceives, how it perceives everybody, how we're meant to just supposedly squeeze ourselves into boxes and not be able to express ourselves properly. And that was up for the Iris Prize. I think it was on Channel 4, but unfortunately, I don't think there's a web link for it at the moment. I think it's still being sold as a short film, which is weird because short films usually don't sell. But I think it's being sold globally as well at the moment. So it should hopefully get back onto something like YouTube or one of the platforms soon. But the story spoke to me mainly, again, because it's that whole thing of not all of society understands us, but as long as some of society understands us, then we're okay. We'll be able to move forward. Those are the two projects that really pop into my mind about things that I'm proud of for a variety of reasons, leaning into sort of the diversity and inclusion space.
It sounds brilliant. Really
good. Yes. Yeah. No,
I'm definitely going to check it on YouTube and send links to Cindy when it's available. So what you've got those kind of in your pocket. What are your future plans? Have you got anything exciting you can share with us?
Do you know what? I have just a little bit of an exclusive because I'm starting to break ground with this now. So the first film that will come out of ViewTorch Pictures is a thriller. It's called IC3. So the collective me, once I've found some other producers to help me out with it. So it's your bog standard thriller about three black friends who have grown together as very precise safecrackers and criminals. And it's just a thriller about how they get caught up in a government conspiracy, egged on by our wonderful police force here in London. That's what I'm putting together at the moment, looking for writers, other producers. It's, again, like a lot of things at the moment, it's at the very early stage. And there's that, and there's another secret project. And then somebody this week has turned me on to another feature film project, which I can't talk about yet until I get some paperwork. So there's a few feature films. From my own slate, there's roughly about 20 films that I'd love to see in the world, film and television ideas. But the whole point of ViewTorch is to see what other people want to bring to life. So it's about bringing in those producers, maybe putting them under a slightly more funded umbrella to help with the development, because development costs in this country can be from £0 to £3,000, depending on, and spending £3,000 over 3 years as a writer doesn't help you. You'll essentially starve unless you have something else to do. So I'm hoping to change the development landscape so that, and also change the kind of films and televisions that come from diverse producers, come from diverse creators. And Yeah, so that's the bigger plan. But yeah, there's a whole bunch of projects I can't even speak about now. There's too many.
That is horrid to do to us. I've got so much going on, but I couldn't possibly tell you any of it. How much we need.
I've given you one biscuit.
Okay. One little nibble on the hook. Yes. Thanks, Paul. You're ever so generous on this Friday morning.
Yes.
Cool. So, Paul, to wrap things up in our final couple of minutes, we are going to have our own new little section of the show where we draw two cards from our deck of conversation cards, which are available through our website if anybody's interested in buying them. So I shall get Sarah do the honours.
Oh, okay. I like the sound of this.
Okay.
Yes.
Question one. If you could be teacher for the day, what would you teach the class?
Oh, God. I don't know. I think there's not a course for it, but I would teach resilience. I would definitely teach resilience and patience. If they started doing this at school, resilience and patience, the one thing we are missing in society now because of the joys of companies we won't mention, but begin with the letter A, and they can send your stuff next day delivery. But one of the problems we have at the moment is that we want everything now, and sometimes now doesn't work. It does, sometimes it doesn't, mainly it doesn't. So we need to teach patience, and we need to teach resilience as well. I think we have in the midst of identifying our own problems in society, we've lost the will to almost tough it out. I'm not saying that you tough it out all the time, because sometimes the problems can become so ginormous that you're unable to actually climb over that hill. But we do have to climb that hill sometimes. And usually resilience is better together, as long as we're in a group. That helps. So if you've got the right support system, then resilience is easy. If you haven't got the right support system, then resilience becomes something else. So if I could teach anything, it would be definitely patience and resilience.
Brilliant.
I know that's not a GCSE, but it'll do.
Very relevant, especially like the instant gratification generation. I'm terrible for it myself. If I can't have an item next day, I'm just not going to bother. I'd rather not.
I'm the same as well.
Okay, final question. Who is your favourite villain in a film?
How long have we got?
We've got two minutes.
Yeah, we've got 2 minutes. There are so many. I was discussing this with Cole Needham, who's the head of IMDb, the Internet Movie Database. And I don't think he could nail it. And I'm having a hard time. I'd like to say Darth Vader. I think, if I think back to my 70s childhood, because I'm a humongous science fiction head, I think that was the point, because I went to see, eventually, when my family could afford it, I went to see Star Wars late. It was a late birthday gift. It came out in 77. We didn't get it here in the UK until December of that year. And then it wasn't until the March of the year afterwards that I eventually dragged myself, when you wouldn't let your kids go out at that age, would you, at 11, on their own, on the bus. This was the 70s. Yeah, let him do whatever the hell. Just give him a fiver and let him enjoy himself. So I went to the Odeon in Streatham and went to see Star Wars. And I think that's the first time I had an awareness of what a villain could be. I'd seen villains before. You watch films on television, you watch films in the cinema, you understand villains. But that was the first time when there was the big neon sign saying villain here. And it just had all of the elements that you needed from a villain. So would I say he was my favourite? Kind of. But yeah, he's definitely, that character's definitely up there with the big neon sign villain, for sure.
Brilliant answer, especially that twist, Luke. I am your father.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's most families, I think. Is that, you know, or, yeah, most of my family, anyway. Yeah.
There's always one.
Yes, yeah. You never know where they come from.
Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you so much for your time. And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in, and look out for our next episode of Together Equal, Diversity Made Simple.